Welcome to the Bardcast. It's Shakespeare, you dick. We are your hosts. I am Lisa Ann Goldsmith.
And I am Owen Thompson. I am the one that never gets to do the introduction, but that's okay.
All right, so let's start all over again.
Welcome to the Bardcast. I did that already.
You're trying to be
that's,
me if listen, I don't have any balls to my voice.
Right, that's I can't. I'm terrible. Okay, here's my one impression. Are you ready?
Yes.
This is my Owen Wilson. Wow. That's it. So, okay, you can do the introductions. It's fine.
All right. Thank you. Today's episode is Sonnet Shakespeare. So, you know, we've talked about the sonnets on a bunch of different episodes, and we have said that we were going to focus an episode on the sonnets, but there are 154, and they're all brilliant in their own way. So we decided that we were going to do a series. This will be the first, called Sonnet Shakespeare, and we invited 20 to 25 of our dear friends and fabulous artists to pick a sonnet and to come onto the pod and perform the sonnet and then talk about it. So in today's episode, Owen and I are going to start off by doing a sonnet each, and then we have our dear friends Patrick Lawler and Keith Howard to round this one out. And then we will go on with this because there's a lot of them, guys, and we think we should talk about them.
Yeah, so we're never going to do more than about four sonnets per episode.
That's
and
right.
We won't just do sonnets for a while. We will sprinkle them into the episode lineup going forward. But we have so many incredibly talented friends, many of whom are known to you and some of whom will be lovely surprises. Today it's Keith and Patrick. Next time it will be somebody else. Exactly.
Four other people.
Yep. So we've talked a lot about the background of the sonnets, and there's so much to say about them, but what we wanted to do was to give the focus to our talented friends so that they could read them and we could talk to them, because they're not only talented, they're so smart. We want to have a conversation about these individual sonnets, but also we want to talk a little bit about the background of how Shakespeare wrote them, or how we think he did, because of course a lot of that is conjecture.
That's right. So there were 154 sonnets, and they were first published in 1609. On May 20th, 1609, Thomas Thorpe went to Stationers Hall and he entered for publication his copy of a book called Shakespeare Sonnets, and the first quarto edition appeared later that year. But here's the weird thing about that. Most of these sonnets were probably written way earlier than that. In fact, two of the sonnets, number 138 and 144, appeared in a 1599 anthology called The Passionate Pilgrim. And also 11 years earlier than the publication, in 1598, Francis Mears alluded to Shakespeare's, as he called them, sugared sonnets among his private friends, etc. His reference suggests that at least some of those 154 were written by 1598, but only available to private friends who were able to gain access to them in a much more restricted sphere of manuscript circulation, right?
And that, of course, was the way sonnets were distributed, really. I mean, the truth is, Shakespeare, by writing sonnets as somebody who was a commoner, was in some ways acting above his station. Sonnets and the sonnet sequence, like these sequences of sonnets that added up to a kind of narrative, were largely the purview of noble practitioners like Sir Philip Sidney, who had really made his mark by writing the Astrophil and Stella sequence, which was hugely popular and eventually got published. But the sugared sonnets, like distributed privately, that refers to like private manuscripts that were handed out privately and discussed amongst well-to-do nobles and folks with money in like private salons and that kind of thing.
Right, and done in private performances for these people.
Yeah, not intended for publication, which is why the sonnets aren't actually officially published until all the way in 1609, when we're reasonably sure that Shakespeare probably wrote the first sonnets in maybe as early as 1592 or 93, when, as we've discussed in many another episode, he had to leave London because of the plague.
That's right.
And no, and more to the point, theater was impossible because the theaters were shut down. So, you know, he needed to make a living. So it is more than possible that he acquired a noble patron, probably the Earl of Southampton, and started writing these sonnets.
That's right. So the sonnets are basically broken down into what we would call the Fair Youth sonnets, which is sonnets 1 to 126, and the Dark Lady sonnets, which starts with 127. All of the beginning sonnets are about his love for and his relationship with a man, a fair youth. And then all of a sudden, this woman appears, described as a dark lady, you know, with unconventional beauty and a very complex relationship. You know, he describes her as evil and like a bad angel, you know, so.
Yeah, and a lot of people are tempted to read Shakespeare's biography into the sonnet sequences. And a lot of people are tempted to infer that he had a relationship, romantic or otherwise, with both of these people. But it's really, as we've so often discussed, it's very hard to read biography into people's writings. It's also important to remember that the sequence, the order of the sequence of the sonnets, 1 to 154, we have no idea if Shakespeare numbered them that way. There's no way to know that. So editors, starting with Thorpe and you know, down over the centuries, have put those sonnets in the order that we know them in. But this is not to say that Shakespeare necessarily did.
That's right.
So whether or not the young man or the dark lady were, you know, lovers of Shakespeare or even actual people, we can't
or
say
patrons,
with any
right?
Right, exactly. We can surmise and we can guess and we can conjecture, but there's nothing that can be proved.
That's right. And to make things even more complicated, a different publisher released another edition of the sonnets in 1640, in which he changed the gender of the fair youth from he to she.
Yeah. So, I mean, Shakespeare had no control. It's important to know. We've talked about it a lot. Shakespeare didn't have any control over any of his work that was published, even the folio, which was, you know, that was published 6 years after his death.
That's right. That's right.
So
Owen and I are going to begin this by reading and talking about the sonnets that we have chosen. Shall I go first?
I think you should.
Thank you. So I have chosen Sonnet 23, which goes like this. As an unperfect actor on the stage who with his fear is put besides his part, or some fierce thing replete with too much rage, whose strength's abundance weakens his own heart, so I, for fear of trust, forget to say the perfect ceremony of love's rite, and in mine own love's strength seem to decay, o'ercharged with burden of mine own love's might. Ah, let my books be then the eloquence and dumb presagers of my speaking breast, who plead for love and look for recompense more than that tongue that more hath more expressed. Oh, learn to read what silent love hath writ. To hear with eyes belongs to love's fine wit. And I love this one because, you know, I think that anybody that has been truly in love feels like this, right? So like he starts off like an actor that, you know, who's got horrible stage fright, forgets his lines, right? Or as somebody that's filled with so much rage, right, that overtakes his love and his positive emotions. So this writer, afraid to trust himself or herself, forgets to complete that kind of ceremony of love's ritual in telling your partner how you feel about them, right? The strength of the speaker's love makes them weak because they're just overwhelmed with the intensity of their love. And so the speaker asks that their books, their writing, be the eloquence and the silent prophets of everything that his or her heart is saying. You know, that those poems are the ones who make the case for the strength of the love and are the ones that look for something in return other than what the other tongue that says more than that person does. And the last two lines are where the speaker begs his love to learn how to read between the lines, learn how to hear what I'm not saying, learn how to hear the unspoken love, and that to hear through the eyes is a skill that belongs to someone who is intelligent in the ways of love and has, as we would use a term today, true emotional intelligence.
Well, yeah, hear through the eyes, right? I mean,
right.
It's like we've spoken about before, Shakespeare's audience would have referred to going to hear a play rather than to see a play. So
that's
it's
right.
the cross-pollination of senses is something that you find a lot of in Shakespeare, right?
Oh my God, absolutely.
And also, you know, as I was just saying, it's dangerous to read his biography into his works. But this sonnet, you know, is a perfect example of why it's so not only tempting to do so, but it's inevitable. Like it's irresistible to try to read biography. And he starts out by, you know, the speaker,
right.
Shakespeare.
Calling himself
himself an actor, right?
And an
imperfect actor, but an actor, right? And, you know, as we've said so many times before, he was a famous actor.
Yes.
You know, much probably more famous as an actor than he was as a writer. But then he talks about his art and his poetry. I mean, he does it time and time again, talking about his verse and his art throughout the sonnet. So, of course, it's tempting. It's super compelling. It really is.
It really is. I just love this one. And, you know, books could be, it really could relate to books of paintings too, you know, or something like that. I mean, I think that it's big. Yes, I understand that it's easy to take it, you know, as biography. But what I'm saying is I think that the poem really, really can be opened up to include anybody who does any kind of creative work.
Well, you know, books could also refer to money.
That's right.
Because he does that too. And that features heavily in the sonnet that I selected, which is sonnet 30. And I swear I didn't select it only because it's triple X. That's just a happy accident. But I will say that
there's nothing about coming this one, so
no.
No.
We're waiting for 129 for that one. Colin Wolf, I have my eye on you.
I did mean come as in semen.
Yes. Oh yeah. No kidding.
Remember, first episode, Filthy Shakespeare.
Exactly. But no, I selected sonnet number 30. And I have to say that I did it for a couple of reasons that might surprise you. I'm a little annoyed with having had to select this sonnet. Because somebody else who shall remain nameless selected sonnet number 29 that immediately precedes it. And that was the one that I originally wanted to do. but also because as brilliant as this sonnet is, there's a couple of things about it that frankly annoy me. And I'll get into that in a moment. I'll just read it first, shall I?
Yes.
So sonnet number 30 goes like this. When to the sessions of sweet silent thought, I summon up remembrance of things past, I sigh the lack of many a thing I sought, and with old woes new wail my dear time's waste. Then can I drown an eye unused to flow for precious friends hid in death's dateless night, and weep afresh love's long since cancelled woe, and moan the expense of many a vanished sight. Then can I grieve at grievances foregone, and heavily from woe to woe tell o'er the sad account of four bemoaned moan, which I knew pay as if not paid before. But if the while I think on thee, dear friend, all losses are restored and sorrows end. So there we have the
vault.
Well, okay. First of all, I'll say there's the voltafas at the end. Like Shakespeare does this constantly. He has 12 lines in one key, and then he totally switches it at the end. He's like, that's basically right. Things suck. And when I think about my dead friends and I get very sad, but then I think about you and I'm fine, right? That's basically what that poem is about. Well, the first thing that annoys me has nothing to do with Shakespeare about this poem, about this sonnet. And it is this. Obviously, the most famous line is the second line in which he references the remembrance of things past. Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, many people will know that as the English title of the Titanic multi-volume Marcel Proust novel, right?
Right.
A la Recherche du Temps Perdu, translated in English as the remembrance of things past. What a lot of people don't know is that remembrance of things past is actually from an apocryphal book of the Old Testament, the Wisdom of Solomon, in which the remembrance of things past is a quote, and Shakespeare lifted it from that, which actually raises a whole host of other questions. How did Shakespeare get his hands on a book of the Apocrypha? But that's for another day. The thing that annoys me is that I misremember the famous English translator who translated Proust in the early part of the 20th century, but the remembrance of things past is a shitty translation of the phrase à la recherche du temps perdu. It does not remotely mean that. À la recherche du temps perdu means in search of lost time.
Which is a totally different thing.
Which does the remembrance of things past and in search of lost time don't have anything to do with one another.
No, absolutely not.
Irritates me. Irritates me. Irritation, I feel it. But again, that's not about Shakespeare. Now, I will say there are some things that I love about this sonnet, and many of which we've touched on in other episodes. When we talked about legal Shakespeare, we talked about his depth of knowledge of the law, mm-hmm. and he totally dips into that in this sonnet. Went to the sessions. Sessions were legal proceedings, right?
That's right. Sessions in court. Court is in session.
Exactly. Exactly. I summon up remembrance of things past. So you're summoned to court, right?
That's right.
So he's dealing with that. And also there's all this alliteration going on. Went to the sessions of sweet silent thought. I summon up remembrance of things past. I mean, it's SSS. I sigh the lack of many a thing I sought. I mean, it's pretty genius that way. But then he also, and this ties into plays like Merchant of Venice, there's a lot of money lending imagery here. I mean, precious friends, right? I weep afresh, love's long since canceled woe.
Right,
things are precious, right. Things are canceled.
On the expense.
The expense, I heavily from woe to woe tell or, like I'm telling money, right?
Right.
The sad account of four bemoaned men, which I knew pay as if not paid before.
That's right.
Right. All of
the
that
last line, all losses are restored.
All losses are restored and sorrows end. But now, and I'm not going to go into this too much, but I want to talk a little bit about Sonnet 29 in comparison to Sonnet 30. And I'm just going to read it briefly. I know somebody else is doing Sonnet 29, so it'll just be a companion episode.
That's right.
So Sonnet 29 briefly goes like this. When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries and look upon myself and curse my fate, wishing me like to one more rich in hope, featured like him with friends possessed, desiring this man's art and that man's scope, with what I most enjoy contented least. Yet in these thoughts, myself almost despising, haply I think on thee. And then my state, like to the lark at break of day arising, from sullen earth sings hymns at heaven's gate. For thy sweet love remembered such wealth brings that then I scorn to change my state with kings. Now, I will be frank and say that that's my favorite fucking sonnet, like of all 154.
29 is a better sonnet than 30.
I'm a little cheesed that I didn't get to do this one. Now, let me tell you why and why Sonnet 30 annoys me. Now, like we've said, there's no way of knowing that Shakespeare wrote 29 and then wrote 30. And in fact, if he did, there's a falling off, because I started by talking about that voltafas, right? He has the list of things that he doesn't like, and then he changes his mind and there's an uplift at the end, right? But listen to the way that it happens in Sonnet 30. It's very abrupt and less artful than it might be, right? He gets all the way to the end. He's still in the main body. Then can I grieve at grievances foregone and heavily from woe to woe tell, or the sad account of four bemoaned moan, which I knew pay as if not paid before. So we got two lines left, and then out of nowhere comes, but if the while I think on thee, dear friend, all losses are restored and sorrows end. Well, that was easy, right?
It almost feels like this sonnet almost feels to me like, you know, whereas 29 is much more artfully arranged, this one is like, bitch, 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 bitch. Oh, whatever substance I'm taking took hold. Now right. I well, can think of you and be happy.
You know, he even actually starts a sentence with the word but, which, you know, hey, who am I to, you know, quibble with Shakespeare? But listen, you know, it's a very abrupt change. But in Sonnet 29, he's talking about his problems. He desires this man's art and that man's scope. With what I most enjoy, contented least. And then in the middle of the line, he's going to change it. Yet in these thoughts, myself, almost, which is a key word, despising, haply I think on thee. So there's the change that comes at the very end of 30. And then he builds this. And then my state, like to the lark at break of day arising from sullen earth, sings hymns at heaven's gate, which also happens to be one of the most beautiful fucking handful of lines ever written in the English language. But, you know, it's a much suppler and a much, to my taste, better written transition.
It has a journey, right? So like the one I did, 23, also has a journey because, you know, he talks about him. He talks about who he is and why he's in the place that he is, you know, because of fear, like forgetting his lines, right? Then what that makes him also forget to do. Then he says, let my art have that eloquence. And then he asks the person to be able to see what the art is giving him. It's a much better constructed sonnet.
I agree.
Both 23 and 29, then 30.
I agree. And I completely agree. And that's one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about 30, because it's a really famous sonnet. And listen, it's genius. It's Shakespeare.
Well, comparative to so many others, yeah.
But if to my taste, and to be fair, the Remembrance of Things Past thing bothers me, and that's not on Shakespeare. But it's actually, for my money, not as good a sonnet as its reputation.
Yep, I would agree with you. I don't think the construction of the journey of the sonnet happens.
No, it's got some beautiful things in it, and it's got a lot of fucking artistry in terms of allusion and word choice and all of that stuff, because duh. But it's not in it with some of the greater sonnets. And I certainly think that 23 and 29 are superior.
I will agree with you absolutely. And shall we jump into our friends here and see which?
Fuck yes, bring them on.
So we would like to welcome a dear friend of the pod and somebody that you all know very well by this time, our dear friend Patrick Lawler. Hi, Patrick.
Hey, everybody. How you doing?
Yeah, well, it's welcoming back.
Yes, he's been with us a bunch of times.
A lot of times. And we're all sober today.
I was just going to say, in all kinds of states of being.
Exactly.
Well, I should say we're all sober as far as our listeners know.
That's right.
as far as you know.
Right, exactly.
Well, I mean, you know, Owen and I were working together today playing a couple looking for a financial advisor. So right. I don't know about you, but I'm pretty stone sober.
Did you learn anything?
You know, what's interesting actually is one of the guys, the guy we liked best, told us that he left Wells Fargo for Morgan Stanley. And I recently moved all of my stuff over from Wells Fargo to Morgan Stanley because, I mean, you know, they're all big financial companies, but Wells Fargo is really the fucking bottom of the barrel as far as like what they do. They're just horrible, horrible people. So
it's true.
I think that's their slogan.
We're horrible people. Well, there's that nice song in Music Man.
Oh yeah.
What? Owen.
Oh, the Wells Fargo wagon.
I know.
Yeah, you're right.
Well, that was, I mean, that was before they were like destroying, you know,
is there,
paying for people to destroy the environment.
I'm just, look, I don't remember a song from, let's say, Cats about Morgan Stanley.
Oh, you don't?
Yeah, it's the one, it's Pergin Stanley. No, I'm kidding.
I think Angie Dinky sings it at
Pergin Stanley. Wow.
I'm, you know, this has gone, this has nothing to do with Shakespeare or sonnets. You know, I'm just saying.
It's we're more just, about dicks. That's so, right. Yeah.
We're getting there. Right.
So, well, and that's closer.
So as we explained to everybody, we have asked a bunch of our dear, fabulous, wonderfully talented friends to pick a sonnet, and they are going to read it for us, and then we'll talk about it and talk about why that is the one they picked. And we're going to start with our dear friend Patrick.
Thank you, because they ran out of the wildly talented people and had too many sonnets. So,
Pishaw.
They had to fill some holes, so they brought me in.
We are not doing all of the sonnets by any stretch of
the
imagination.
No, God, no. There's 154.
Yeah, we're not. No, 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 and no.
155, because Daly just wrote one.
That's right. He did write one, and I think we actually should make him speak that one.
Is that the one about Nantucket?
Yes. He wrote that for our friend Alvin, also a well-known friend of the pod. So
yes.
Absolutely.
All right, but dive right in, Patrick. Tell us which one you're doing, and if you would be so kind.
I have chosen Sonnet LX, which, for those of you who would rather speak in numbers, it's Sonnet 60. And just a little bit about... well, let me do it first, and then we'll talk about it.
Yeah.
Great.
Like as the waves make toward the pebbled shore, so do our minutes hasten to their end. Each changing place with that which goes before, in sequent toil all forwards do contend. Nativity, once in the main of light, crawls to maturity, wherewith, being crowned, crooked eclipses gainst his glory fight, and time that gave doth now his gift confound. Time doth transfix the flourish set on youth, and delves the parallels in beauty's brow, feeds on the rarities of nature's truth, and nothing stands but for his scythe to mow. And yet, to times, in hope, my verse shall stand, praising thy worth, despite his cruel hand.
Patrick, I just want to say that I could listen to you talk for like hours on end.
And you have, and you will.
Not for nothing do you do the audiobooks.
It's true.
Yeah, well, you know, talking is one of them things, you know, it's just like, as you get older, certain things that you love, you can't do as much, but talking ain't one of them.
That's so, certainly true.
Anyway, just a little bit of background on why I chose this. I'm going to just kind of jump into it. I went to the wonderful University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee back in the day before it became the University of Delaware. And it had a wonderful, wonderful classical theater department. But it was a little, I don't know, quirky, I guess is a good word, where we didn't do scene work per se. What we did was, anybody who's done a lot of acting would know what like a nonsense scene is, where you basically have words that may or may not make sense, or you may be taking them out of context, or you may be doing nursery rhymes or whatever, and you basically pretend a scene using those as your dialogue. Well, we used sonnets for everything.
Wow.
We used them for just about all our non play-related scene work. We used them for this wonderful exercise that we did called Suzuki.
Oh yeah!
Again, people that are familiar with classical theater probably know a little bit about it. It's a wildly bizarre series of Japanese exercises to build your vocal ability and your core and your strength and your just general stage awesomeness. And we would use these for that. So basically, before we got there, they just sent us all random sonnets picked, you know, supposedly for us, but not really. And mine was this. And they said, memorize this, have this memorized when you get there. And we did. And then we picked it apart for speech class. We used it for deep resonance for voice class. We yelled it at each other for Suzuki. We stood in terribly uncomfortable positions, screaming it to the gods, just for 3 years, you know. So I basically deconstructed this damn thing to the point where it no longer made any sense whatsoever. And then over the years, you know, when I graduated back in, you know, 1850, I I just said, never, ever again, I'm never looking at this fucking thing. And I put it away. And then, like about 10 years later, I was doing like a benefit for the Pasadena Shakespeare Company in Pasadena, California, where we dressed up as Shakespeare and ran all over the place for Valentine's Day, reading sonnets. And somebody suggested this one. Somebody requested it, that I go deliver a Shakespeare gram to somebody with this. And I'm thinking, wow, you sick so-and-so. And why on Valentine's Day would you remind somebody that you're going to die? And everything's going to die. But so anyway, it popped its ugly head up again. And it's basically popped its ugly head up every 5 or 10 years ever since. And I don't know, I just by default have come to love it. I mean, the message of it is something that has changed meaning for me over the years. I first dealt with it when I was in my 20s, and at that time it was just this you know, it was kind of like a warning. It was kind of like a cautionary tale that, you know, when you're in your 20s, you don't really think about mortality. So I was thinking, well, this is something we're all going to grow old. Now that I'm old, and now that, you know, the waves have been beating on those pebbled shores for many years, the kind of the warmth and the beauty and the inevitability of the fact that this is what we're intended for. This is everybody. This always happens, you know. The waves go to the shore, and as inevitably as that happens, we're on our way to the end of our journey. And it's going to happen. You're going to have this wonderful youth, or you're going to have a youth. I can't say it'll be wonderful for everybody. And, you know, that's going to happen. You're going to be pretty, and then all of a sudden lines are going to form in your face, and all the wonderful things that time has promised you when you were a kid and you used to think, oh, I can't wait. Well, now it's here, and guess what? It's different. And guess what? It's all going to be over, and you're going to be gone really soon. And oddly, that's very comforting. And then it as I get older, I notice a hint of defiance in the last two lines.
I would, you know, it's so funny that you say that. I was going to use the same word, the defiance. And it runs throughout a lot of the sonnets the same way.
Yeah, well, I think these are as he's getting, and 60 is like right smack in the middle. But he's getting older, and he's like, he knows that. And yet, you know, my verse is going to stand up against time praising you. You know, no matter what happens, you know, in hope, my verse is going to stand, hopefully, against time. And it's funny because it's depending on how you read it, it can be a lot of different things, you know. And yet to time and hope, my verse shall stand. Like, I hope my verse will stand. My most current reading of it is much more defiant than that, where it's like my verse is the hope that will stand against time praising your worth. You know, no matter what time can do to it, your worth is always going to be there chronicled in my verse for all time. So, you know, it's fun. And that's the wonderful thing about these is as you age, your experience with these sonnets changes.
Yeah,
and your understanding of them changes.
Well, they, you, You know, they say you if you read a book at different ages, or in this case a sonnet, it also reads you, right? I mean, it's different at 60 than it is at 20. And, you know, speaking of that, the defiance that, I mean, I detect it there too. I mean, isn't that like the defiance of basically all art?
To say, yeah, you know, that it will hold ars, up against time. It will say
ars longa vita brevis, right?
Yeah.
So
and I love the one thing I love about this is that, you know, he uses the image of the scythe, you know, and it's like, which is such a death image.
Oh, right? Yeah.
Although yeah. he's sort of like he, you know, he relates it to time. So it seems to me like he equates time and death in this sonnet.
Well, time is the great reaper, you know, it's like nothing stands, but goodbye. Yeah.
It makes me think of one of my favorite descriptions of time from his friend Ben Jonson, who called time that old bald cheater.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah. I love it. I a similar image, but, you know, a little less serious. When I turned 40, somebody gave me a coffee cup, and basically it was a cartoon of a man on roller skates standing on the top of a hill, looking down. And he had obviously come up one side and is now going down the other.
Yeah.
And it's just, you know, it's the journey, and it's the journey we're all going to take. And there's a cliff at the bottom, and then you can't see anything past that. So it's
That reminds me, not that, I mean, now we're talking about coffee cups and birthday cards. The most horrifying birthday card I ever saw was a very realistic Grim Reaper on the front with a giant birthday cake with far too many candles on it. And inside, all it said was, "You can run, but you can't hide."
I think I sent that to you, Owen.
And I'm like, okay, where's the joke in that? Isn't this supposed to be like a mean, funny card? But that's just fucking true.
When you're closer to the end, old man.
Pretty sure I sent that to you, Owen.
I hope so. Maybe I have it somewhere. I mean, I loved it, but it's pretty fucking dark.
Yeah, well, but it's absolutely 100% true. You can run, but you can't hide.
You can't hide.
That's what I think when I look at a lot of people, a lot of famous Hollywood actors that have had all this work done to their face, and I'm like, bitch, it's coming no matter
Nicole,
what you do.
You can paint an inch thick, but to this favor you must come.
Yeah, that tramp stamp just doesn't look the same at 80, does it?
That's why I never got a tattoo. I don't want to see it get all wrinkled and shitty.
Yeah, I guess that's true. I wanted one that somehow like developed some funny quirk as my wrinkles or my fat came in, but I just couldn't like one that maybe as my arms kind of wither as I get older develops a mouth,
right?
So I can make talk or well something.
The only one David, I ever really considered was when I played Lady Mac, and I wanted a tiny little dagger on the back of my neck.
Nice.
So that it was hidden. But then
our friend David Hamilton claims to have the only tattoo that I think is worth having. He likes to tell people that on his ass, his whole ass is tattooed with the likeness of a human ass.
Yeah, I could see Hamilton actually going in and asking for that.
Asking for that, yes.
Speaking of David Hamilton, you know, Jaws was on TV when we were in Cancun. I was like, geez,
was it really?
David's getting another check.
Jeez, not a show I want to see when I'm in Cancun.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that's not exactly, well, good for David.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
It's actually, the resort had all of these. They had the beach out to a certain extent, like gated off with those dark gates, or like, you know, I guess they're like mesh, but they keep any large fish.
Any great white sharks from coming in and, yes, you know, preventing you from getting aided.
That's right.
Yeah.
For those of you who don't know, and for those of you who are in the north where Owen and Lisa Ann are, Lisa Ann just spent the last week in Cancun. So I'm just catching them all up on that.
So boo-hoo.
Yeah.
Hey, man. Much needed. The last time I had a vacation like that was 2001. So
you sound so much refreshed.
I am so refreshed. I'm so refreshed, and I highly recommend it to anybody.
You know, I think there should be a universal week in Cancun this week. And it's like the last month or so has just been a
maybe we should establish like a sonnet vacation in Cancun.
Hey, I'm in.
I'm just trying to bring the conversation back to fucking sonnets.
Yes, please. Sorry.
I mean, you know, we are talking about time going and, you know, getting closer to death. As that happens, though, you recognize that some of the things that you don't give yourself in your youth are things that you absolutely need to be giving yourself as you head more towards the end of your life. So
good one. Nicely done. Yeah, it's you have to feed on those rarities of nature's truth. So, and nothing's truer about nature than the beach at Cancun. So,
that's and it. Death.
And death. Thank you. Thanks for bringing that back.
I'm sorry. As far as I know, Sonnet 60 is more about death than it is about, you know, Cancun.
Which is, you know, my next point, or maybe my first point, who knows, it's lovely the way he never mentions death. He never actually
says
you're going to die. He doesn't say anything. Our minutes are hastening toward their end. That's it. You know, at some point, we're just not going to have any minutes left. He doesn't have, kind of like this show. But you know,
oh, there's always minutes left on this show.
We are almost, we have, after this sonnet episode, we have one more episode that is the last episode of our second year.
Oh my God. Isn't that amazing? Who'd have thunk it?
Who'd have thunk?
Congratulations.
Thank you, coronavirus.
See, there's a bright side to everything. If it wasn't for the plague, we wouldn't have King Lear. So,
yeah, I mean,
you know,
luckily we still had Shakespeare through the plague. So,
yeah. Well, luckily we still have you two through this.
I only found out recently that John Fletcher died of the plague.
Is that right?
Wow.
Yeah, many years later, kept coming back, but Fletcher died of the plague.
Wow, I always wondered if any of his company members were affected. I mean, were,
well, they must have been. They must have been.
How could
I'm sure there's many that we don't know about. But Fletcher, many years after Shakespeare died, died of the plague. So, you know, it was a popular way to go.
Rest in pieces, John Fletcher. Well, thank you, Patrick, for joining us.
Always a pleasure.
You're so welcome, and it's so refreshing to see both of you, like, you know, without the aid of alcohol. So, you know, with my eyes clear and, you know, just my...
We'll
put an end to that next time.
I will.
I'm looking forward to the day when we can do a live episode with an audience and invite all of our friends to come.
Indeed. Yeah. Although I will say there's something cool about recording this right now in three separate states.
That's true.
I love this. Yeah.
Texas, New York, and Pennsylvania.
And when we have Daly and Alvin with us, then
that's
we're
right.
doing it in Alvin, two separate countries.
And where was Alvin? He was in Belgium
in
or something.
Yeah, Belgium.
Paris. That,
you know,
globe-trotting bitch.
Kidding, right? Jeez, I'm still going on about that. I still have all these, like, I still have all these flashes back to your nickname. So, you know, that we never actually delved into, and maybe on another episode we will.
But perhaps we will.
Not this time. Well, my darlings, this is. Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you.
Anytime and all the time.
We love you.
Oh, back at you, both of you.
And now we would like to welcome to the pod our dear, dear friend, Keith Howard, who you guys know from many things on the pod, including 'Twas the Night Before, What did we call it?
Well, we call it a visit from St. Falstaff.
That's right.
It's our version of "Twas the Night Before Christmas."
That's right. That features... was a long time ago, you guys, and it's been a long day.
And Keith will be very recognizable to you as the mellifluous voice of Falstaff, and indeed the narrator of that entire poem, for which we are eternally grateful.
That's right. So welcome, Keith. Good to see you and hear you. Would you tell us what sonnet you've chosen and why, and then would you do it for us?
Of course, and I'm so thrilled to be here on the Bardcast with you guys. And I chose Shakespeare's sonnet number 66, which starts out, "Tired with all these, for restful death I cry." And I can go into it.
Please do.
Please do.
"Tired with all these, for restful death I cry, as to behold desert, a beggar born, and needy nothing, trimmed in jollity, and purest faith unhappily forsworn, and gilded honor shamefully misplaced, and maiden virtue rudely strumpeted, and right perfection wrongfully disgraced, and strength by limping sway disabled, and art made tongue-tied by authority, and folly doctor-like controlling skill, and simple truth miscalled simplicity, and captive good attending captain ill. Tired with all these, from these would I be gone, save that to die I leave my love alone."
Oh, Keith.
Bravo.
Bravo. Bravo. You know, we have two of my favorite voices of all times on this podcast this week. You know,
well, we're batting 1,000 so far, aren't we? I mean, just in terms of like how privileged we are to just hear you guys read these sonnets. I mean,
and make them alive. It's so incredible.
Yep.
So let's talk about it. You had mentioned something earlier, and I think we should bring that up.
Well, yeah, I was mentioning to you before you started recording about the fact that, you know, this poem does have an element of the regarding suicide. And, you know, obviously some people will be very sensitive to that topic, but I don't really think the poem is about suicide at all. I don't even think it's about all of the horrible ills in the world that are detailed in these 11 lines full of bullet points.
Yes.
Where Shakespeare, with razor sharp, laser focused 10 syllable lines, just takes down, you know, one evil of the world after another. It's really not about that. What the poem is about is the last six syllables, the romantic mega sacrifice that this speaker is making in remaining alive in this disgusting world that he has just described in great detail for the benefit of the person he loves, so that the person he loves doesn't have to go it alone in this disgusting society. It's a huge sacrifice after, you know, this long tirade of one bullet point after another. I think 10 of the lines of this poem start with the word "and."
Yeah.
He's going on, he's on a roll.
Talk
he's
about a list.
And this, and that, and this, and can you believe that? And this, and finally at the end, he says, "I would knock myself off in a moment. I would happily accept death, except that I have someone I love. I cannot leave that person alone in this crap world. And so I've got to keep on living for him." That's what this poem is about to me.
Yeah, I would totally agree. And you know what I find so interesting just about the structure of this poem? And like you were saying, you know, there's 10 lines that begin with and. If you look at most other sonnets, it kind of has like three, maybe four sort of like points about it, right? Like beats, as an actor would say. But this one has like one line at the beginning that sets it up, and then a long list, as you said, a tirade, and then a closing line.
That's exactly right. You have an intro with one line,
right,
which is basically repeated in the second line from the end. It's almost the exact same sentiment,
right?
And then you have, in those last 10 syllables, you have the whole point of the poem, following 11 bullet points.
Amazing.
Each one showing these horrendous paradoxes of the way that we live in this world and the way that the world treats us and the way that we treat one another. And by the way, the really sad thing, perhaps one of the most tragic things about this poem, is that it was written, 400 something years ago. And all of these things are still completely relevant. In fact, perhaps even more relevant.
Oh, frighteningly relevant. Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Frighteningly relevant, exactly. Well, the world may have even gotten worse since Shakespeare's day.
Times change, but people don't, right? And Shakespeare, you know, you're so right about all of that. And two things occurred to me listening to you read it, other than my admiration. You're right about that list of all the terrible things. It inevitably makes one think of To Be or Not to Be.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Which really obviously is the most famous soliloquy of all time, that treats of the thoughts of suicide. Right. And again, Hamlet does the same thing. He has a fucking laundry list. And because he's not confined to the 14 lines of a sonnet, it actually goes on even longer. And, you know, who would fardels bear to grunt and sweat under a weary life, and the pangs of despised love, the law's delay, et cetera, et cetera.
Just wrong. Proud man's
but exactly. Unfortunately for Hamlet, you know, at least the speaker of this sonnet, whether it was true in Shakespeare's life, you know, as you say, he's holding on for the person that he loves. But, you know, Hamlet, if anything, you know, feels that he is about to find out that Ophelia is betraying him by spying for her father. Right.
Mm-hmm.
So, and he can't really marry her anyway for political reasons, but that's a whole other thing. So obviously there's a parallel there. And also, isn't it interesting how the structure of so many sonnets does exactly what this sonnet does, and does a whole, sometimes it's 8 lines, sometimes it's 11 lines, but there's almost always a voltifoss at the end, right?
Yeah.
Or often there is.
Yeah.
And there's a change. Sometimes it comes in the middle, sometimes it comes at the very end, but it's right there. And it's like despair, 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 hope. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he waits until the very last line for that here.
Mm-hmm.
And you're exactly right about Hamlet's soliloquy, and in that it presents all of these evils of the world, or the ills of the world, in a long list. He comes to the conclusion that you can't kill yourself, because what about that eternal sleep of nightmares that might follow, right?
Right.
And the speaker of this poem says, I can't kill myself because I got to be there for my boy, my guy.
Which, frankly, is a much more noble, I think, decision.
Yeah, tremendously noble, romantic, and tragic.
Yeah.
And the other thing, of course, in Hamlet is that one reason he pauses is he speaks of the, you know, the death as the bourne from which no traveler returns.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the most interesting thing to me about that is a hell of a thing to say if you've just been speaking with the ghost of your father. Because he refers to death as the bourne from which no traveler returns, having spoken to someone who did return.
Just did return.
Which is fucking weird.
Well, I mean, I think there's a little bit of no, that didn't happen. That didn't happen. That
can't. Well, sure. I mean, later on, he has the whole thing about the spirit I have seen may be a devil,
right,
and
right,
blah blah blah. So he has, that leads to the plays, the thing wherein I'll catch the conscience of the king. But you know, he did have a pretty lengthy conversation with his dad.
Well, sure.
And other people saw that ghost,
right,
too.
That's right.
In fact, if other people hadn't seen that ghost, he would never have had that conversation, because they came and told him about it.
That's
so.
Right.
I'm saying is it's weird.
If Shakespeare plays were subject to the contributors to IMDb, that would be listed as a continuity error or a goof.
Well, but because it, you know, because it's Shakespeare, and you know, I honestly, I have to give it up. I hate to say this. I never noticed that particular glitch, if you will, until I read about it in the writings of Harold Bloom, who I more or less otherwise despise, and his work drives me crazy. His criticism annoys me, but I have to give it up. He mentioned that, and I was like,
although Harold Bloom, if you want to come on the pod and talk about it, we will be happy to have you.
Well, he would also have to return from that bourne because he's fucking dead.
Yeah, I know.
But you know, if
hey, we're talking Hamlet, to ghosts, goddamn it,
Daddy's ghost can come back.
Yeah, sure.
Who knows? I'll volunteer myself for the part of Harold's ghost.
Thank you.
Great.
Love that.
Yeah, that son of a bitch bastard. He's like likely to come back.
I think my favorite, or my most hated line in this sonnet is, "And art made tongue tied by authority." I mean, because don't we fucking know what that's like?
Exactly. We see that one every time. And it's got, you know, this kind of double. What I liked about that is the tongue stops and the glottal stops and the alliteration in that line.
Yeah.
The glottal stop of art and authority. And then the tongue stops of tongue tied. Because it's showing that just that sound of those words are showing that what I want to say, I can't say it because something's getting in the way.
Right. And he combines glottal stops with alliteration. You know, I mean, he was obviously such a master, but you know, speaking of art tongue tied by authority, I mean, he was subject to the master of the revels coming and weighing in on every, I mean, not just him, but everybody,
right.
You know, you couldn't just write a play and put it on. You had to submit it for approval to an official of the crown.
Right.
And that must have fucking sucked.
Talking about,
I mean, and a lot of people went to jail over that and Shakespeare himself came close to losing his life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, as did the company when Richard II was, commissioned by the supporters of the Earl of Essex. We've talked a lot about that.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I mean, it was dangerous. You know, it was dangerous times to be writing.
Another word thing that I like in here is correct perfection, right? Mm-hmm. Because you can just feel it being spit out.
Yeah, right perfection, wrongfully disgraced, right and then wrong.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is then the next line where he says limping sway, and then you have to pronounce the ED on disabled, which sounds really limping to me. Limping sway, disabled.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Of course, you know, as far as the, you know, the first two lines of the list where you say desert a beggar born and needy nothing, trimmed in jollity, it doesn't take a lot for us to imagine a person who is a needy nothing, a completely worthless bum who somehow managed to acquire lots of fortune and lots of fame and lots of power. Remind us of anyone that we know.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's something to
it be said. It actually reminds me of quite a few people.
Yeah.
Yes. You know, something to be said for birthright, right? Mm-hmm. It's only, a product. You're only a product of where you come from, not necessarily where you deserve to be.
Yeah, that, I mean, that's the whole most of these lines could just basically be summed up in saying, unfair, unfair, this is so unfair. Can you believe how unfair this is? You know, but it's Shakespeare, and so each line is a little 10-syllable gem all by itself. I mean, you could literally take each one of these lines and use it as the central conflict for a play.
Totally. I love And Folly
Doctor. And he did that too, by the way.
I love And Folly Doctor-like.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Well, there's Shakespeare going, you know, with his references to other professions.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sigh.
But you know what? I was thinking about this poem, I remembered this kind of poem that I used to have on my wall in my office when I worked at Actors Equity, and it was supposed to be an inspirational poem. I think it was written by some Christian inspirational writer, and it's called Do It Anyway. Do you guys know that?
No.
Sounds familiar.
And it's basically a list of all of the horrible things that will happen to you in the world if you try to do good, but you should still do it anyway. So it's a kind of a more up with people kind of attitude about these same things. It goes, you know, people are illogical, unreasonable, and self-centered. Love them anyway. If you do good, people will accuse you of selfish, ulterior motives. Do good anyway. If you are successful, you'll win false friends and true enemies. Succeed anyway. And goes on to say that, you know, give the world, the last line is, give the world the best you have and you'll get kicked in the teeth. Give the world the best you have anyway. And, you know, that is a, you know, it's a useful thing to have that, you know, encouragement. It's a little hard to actually do it in real life, you know, but it's, this is the more sunny side of these ills or evils that Shakespeare is mentioning. This guy, his name is Kent M. Keith. I think he wrote this, Keith by happenstance. And, you know, he's looking at it from a different point of view. Let's try to turn this around and let's try to make something happier of these evils in the world.
Well, it's certainly more, it's a little more uplifting than...
Yeah, it's more upbeat than save that to die. I leave myself alone.
But the latter is Shakespeare.
That's so right.
And, well, I mean, and so certainly better written.
Absolutely. You know, that's a...
It's a high bar.
It is a high bar.
It's kind of... I don't think Mr. Keith was going for... Shakespeare
if somebody,
quality.
Yeah, if somebody says, you know what, it's good, but it isn't Shakespeare, that's not actually much of a criticism.
That's right. What do you expect?
Yeah, I think I could, you know, take, well, I mean, just hearing it, I know that it's some sort of like Christianity-based thing.
Oh yeah, he was a Christian philosopher of some kind, but there's no there it doesn't mention, you know, Jesus in it at all. It's just it's meant to be, you know, uplifting and to keep you positive. I had a lot of stresses in my job.
Oh, yeah, I remember
the labor union.
Sure.
And so I had a lot of, you know, inspirational quotes tacked onto my wall, and this was one of them.
Oh my God. Listen, whatever gets you through the
whatever
day.
Works.
Yeah, if
whatever
I had put on at 66 on my wall, I would never have gotten to work.
Right, exactly. Exactly.
Except if you put Sonnet 66 with a big picture of Yucca next to it.
That's exactly true. And you know, to tell you the truth, you know, you don't get through life, you know, I'm 61 years old. You don't get through life without thinking about how horrible the world is and the reason why you keep going. And for a lot of us, you know, one of the real reasons to keep going and, you know, bearing all these fardels, if you'll pardon the expression, is...
He said fart. No.
That's right. Is for the people that we love.
Yeah.
I have a wonderful wife. I have friends like you guys. You know, it's reason enough to keep going.
Of course
well,
it is.
Well, it certainly helps us keep going, right?
Yeah.
To have each other there. So.
And we're so grateful that you're not only our friend, but a friend of the show.
That's right.
And we thank you so much for coming on our show and reading that sonnet so beautifully.
Thank you.
No one will ever be able to do it again, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, all I'll say is don't listen to the Gielgud recital on YouTube then.
Pshaw! Gielgud has nothing on Howard.
Yes, just pretend that Gielgud never recorded this.
Well, thank you, Keith. We love you very much.
Been my pleasure.
So great to see you. Thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure.
What an absolute joy this first Sonnet Shakespeare episode has been.
A great beginning. We can't wait to have other friends on. I think this, I hope you guys are enjoying it as much as we are, because We're just having a blast.
We are. And if you have anything to say, or if you have a sonnet that is your favorite, please, please, we'd love to hear from you. Write us at thebardcastyoudick@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. Visit our website at www.thebardcastyoudick.com. If please don't be shy to support our podcast by subscribing to the pod, visiting our Patreon page, or even our PayPal link.
Yeah, you can give us a one-time donation if you like via that PayPal donation link. Or if you have extra money and you feel like helping a lot of other artists, you can. We have links on our website to Broadway Cares, Equity Fights AIDS, and the Actors Fund. And remember,
it's Shakespeare, you dick!
The preceding podcast was a production of Country Matters, LLC, copyright 2022, all rights reserved.